diagnosed with a common cold, given ibuprofen and antibiotics, and released. But the boy continued to become more ill throughout the day. After he began vomiting, the boy was sent back to the same hospital, but fell unconscious along the way. He was pronounced dead just before midnight Christmas morning. The cause of death is not yet known. The boy was first detained along with his father on December 18th. The Trump administration said it was investigating the latest death and that it had ordered medical checks of every child in its custody. This follows the death of a 7-year-old indigenous Guatemalan girl, Jacqueline Calmaquin, who died on December 8th. Also in New Mexico, 2 days after she and her father presented themselves at the border in a bid for asylum. While he talked endlessly about the border wall, Donald Trump has neither tweeted nor spoken about the dead children. The deaths have drawn international condemnation and calls for a thorough, independent investigation.
The Donald Trump administration has announced a major rollback of the nation's clean water regulations. The rule change decreases the number of waterways protected by the U.S. Clean Water Act. Critics warn this could result in expanded oil drilling and mining in once protected areas and lead to an increase in chemical pollutants, including pesticide runoff. The proposal is the latest in the Trump administration's efforts to weaken environmental laws after loosening regulations for car emissions, mercury and coal, and opening up previously protected areas for gas and oil drilling.
The time now, 32 and a half minutes past 12 o'clock. So for the moment, we'll wish you a very good afternoon.
If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Suggested for mature audiences.
I'm Natasha Alford from The Griot, and I'm here with some special breaking news. New reports prepared for the Senate Intelligence Committee reveal that Russia specifically targeted the black community during the 2016 presidential election. That's right. Anyone who told you our vote didn't count missed the memo. And they targeted us more than any other group they spent money on. According to the report, Russian agents set up fake Facebook pages, Instagram accounts, and even YouTube channels called Don't Shoot and Black to Live to build an audience of black folks and convince them not to vote. According to the report, quote, the voter suppression effort was focused particularly on Sanders supporters and African Americans, urging them to shun Mrs. Clinton in the general election and either vote for Ms. Stein or stay home. One example post read, no lives matter to Hillary Clinton, only votes matter to Hillary Clinton. And another, not voting is a way to exercise our rights. That don't even sound like us. And just in case you thought our beloved hashtags were safe, Russians apparently targeted black women too, earning tons of likes on posts with hashtags like Black Power, Unapologetically Black, and Black Girls Killing It. That one was obviously a Russian bot. Do we even say things like that? Do we? If anyone thinks this news doesn't matter because Russians targeted everyone, consider this. Hillary Clinton lost very closely to Donald Trump in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, states with major urban cities like Detroit, Philly, and Milwaukee, where black voter turnout was much less than expected. And Russian trolls apparently didn't just target black folk, they impersonated us online. With fake accounts, joining discussions on both political sides to hype up division. And they apparently have been doing this for years, being active during the Civil Rights Movement era and during the trial of the Scottsboro Boys in the 1930s. Many black leaders have been upset by this news, including Sherrilyn Ifill, president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. She tweeted, "This is why it infuriates me when our community ignores the Russia investigation. Black voters were a key target of this misinformation and manipulation effort by Russia. Race is the most reliable source of division in American politics. Understand what this means. Black voters are now the only segment of the American electorate that must fight against voter suppression efforts by state and local governments within our country and against voter suppression efforts organized by foreign governments. Basically, we're being attacked on all fronts." Multiple studies have revealed black people are early adopters of social media. We're leaders, and particularly when it comes to Instagram, where we have the highest participation rates compared to other racial groups. Okay, so what does this mean for us? Protect our privacy? Fact check and double check the sources we're reading? Showing up to the polls no matter what and staying engaged in the political process. All right, so hit us in the comments with your thoughts. No robots or fake accounts, please. And hit up thegrio.com for more on this story.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for the smart of the region.
Este es Aboriginal Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
The Facebook ads bought by the Russians to influence the 2016 presidential campaign. Our senior media and politics reporter Dylan Byers has exclusive reporting on this. Dylan, tell our viewers what you're learning from your sources.
Here's what we've learned, Wolf. At least one of the ads that was bought by this Russian troll farm on Facebook was a Black Lives Matter ad that was targeted specifically to the cities of Baltimore and Ferguson, Missouri, obviously two cities where by that point in either late 2015 or early 2016, two cities which had been the site of some of the largest and most violent protests over the police shootings of African American men. This is the first example we have to date of where these ads were specifically targeted. Again, this is one ad out of more than 3,000, so we shouldn't infer that every single ad, or most of the ads even, were about the Black Lives Matter issue. But what it tells us is that the Russians who bought these ads were sophisticated enough to understand that targeting a Black Lives Matter ad to the communities of Baltimore and Ferguson would help sow political discord, which we believe was one of the motives here with these ad buys.
I want to get into that a little bit more, Dylan. This ad, the Russians actually thought that by using this ad in this platform and targeting these people in Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, that it would have a positive, from their perspective, impact the meddling in the election?
That's right. You know, we tend to want to think about this as these ads maybe promoting one candidate, criticizing another candidate. It's not that simple. What we understand, and this is based off of my conversation with my sources, is that the goal here was really about creating chaos, creating a climate of incivility, a climate of political discord and partisanship, effectively to sort of undermine the American Democratic Project generally, to undermine America's strength at home, also to sort of weaken the argument that may have tempted old Soviet bloc states that Western democracy was sort of the be-all, end-all and the grand goal of where they should be heading. Doing this, basically promoting Black Lives Matter, while at the same time maybe, you know, to other residents of Baltimore and Ferguson, a Black Lives Matter ad might seem as though the group is a threat, contributes to that sort of culture and atmosphere of divisiveness, of incivility, of chaos. And we you know, when we look at it, as more of these ads come out and we understand more of where those ads were targeted, we might begin to sort of get a fuller picture of how Russians thought they could create that climate here in the United States.
And as you point out, Dylan, this is what, just the tip of the iceberg, this one ad that you're reporting on. Do you expect that we will learn more about how these ads were targeted?
I do, but, Wolf, the way I expect that will happen is through leaks like these. I do not anticipate that Facebook is going to want to leak these ads. They haven't even given the ads over to the House and Senate Intelligence Committees yet, which is something that they promised they would do last week. Once Congress has its hands on those ads, they might want to review them before releasing any of the ads themselves. So it's one of these things, as we see so often in Washington, where it's sort of a drip, 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 and we get more details as the days goes on.
Why won't they release the ads publicly? I mean, they were public information before. Why not release them?
It's a great question, Wolf. And when we put that question to Facebook, the answer we hear back is privacy concerns. I think Facebook also understands that it's sort of a slippery slope when you start acquiescing to government demands about releasing certain information. If you start doing that here in the United States, what other governments around the world does Facebook have to start responding to with certain requests about releasing information? But look, as a civilian, it's a very hard argument to swallow. These ads were public. They did influence voter sentiment during the course of the 2016 campaign. Obviously, they were meant to sort of throw our political system into turmoil. Why can't we see these ads? That's a question that Congress has, and I think it's a question many Americans.
Internet radio for smarter than
original. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the fourth world from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, the Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the people of the fourth world from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com, as well as our main news portal, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. And along with my co-executive producer and master studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales, we welcome you back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, coming straight at you from Everyman Studios in unceded Chinook and People's Territories in occupied North America. This is the first show for 2019. We're glad you're still with us. We began this broadcast November 2001, I believe was the first official show. We're still glad to be here. Some of you have actually, there's a handful of you who have still actually stuck around, for almost that long. And again, I really appreciate it. That's the main reason I still you know, it's the listeners that makes me come back, to be honest with you. The fact that you're taking time out of your day to hear what I have to say, to basically hear what Lupe and I are, concerned about, what we have an interest in, things that we think that you should be concerned about. I mean, this is supposed to be a Fourth World broadcast, and it is. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, they asked, you know, since we're here in January, before we get into anything political, if you're a newcomer, you should know that we don't have a script. I might have a slight, you know, idea of what I might talk about when I come in here, but then once we get in here, you know, we've read the news two or three times, or heard the radio, or she's told me something that I didn't know about, or vice versa. So, you know, there's no telling. And because it's ad hoc like that, and we're sometimes all over the place in terms of our subject matter, we appreciate everybody that comes in here. Be you indigenous, be you non-indigenous. You know, obviously we talk about a lot of issues that affect African people, especially African people in the Americas, in the diaspora, period, you know. Africans in the Arab world, Africans in Asia. You know, we talk about African subjects. And, you know, I know there's a lot of confusion about African automatically meaning indigenous. We should know that that isn't necessarily the case, which could lead me, frankly, Lupin, to what I wanted to talk about. You know, but I feel like I'm being redundant, because that's what I've been talking about, is the lack of understanding that a lot of people are showing. And one of the reasons this broadcast goes off into so many different directions, besides the fact that, you know, I do not consider myself to be a limited human being at all. I consider myself to be a citizen of the world. But at the same time, you know, I know who I am. I know all of the groups that which I'm connected to, their personal and historical reasons in terms of why that is. I know I'm not the only one. I know there are many of you out there that are not just biracial, but multiracial. Right? And even if you're biracial, whatever, you know, racial is supposed to mean. And even though, you know, let's be honest too, you know, race itself does not have a scientific construct, because it isn't scientific. It's a social construct. And we can continue to ignore race all we want, because that's precisely what the racists are feeding off of. It sounds strange, doesn't it? I mean, it's just like when we ask for non-bias laws or anti-racism laws and so on. Now, there have to be rules for society. I'm sorry. You know, as much as I enjoy anarchist writing and so on, and I believe in it as a philosophy, I just haven't seen it work. You know, the way that, I mean, was it Christiania? Is that the name of it, Luke? The autonomous community in Denmark. I believe it's called Christiania. You don't know what I'm talking about. I believe it's called Christiania. If it's even still up, they are a anarchist, collective. They don't have taxes. They do everything collectively and so on, and they don't have any problems. But you got to understand something. They have had problems in the past. I have no idea what's going on now, but, you know, they got biker gangs up there, copying what was happening in California in the late 40s and 50s. I guess they saw the Wild Bunch or something with Brando and decided that they were going to, because the automobile came a few decades before that, and that really changed their culture over there. I only know this because I've read about it and seen documentaries about it. It was a big difference, you know, what happened in Swedish society when the automobile came. So when the motorcycle came, I don't know exactly when these leather boys started over there, but right now they're over there, and yeah, you know, they're making the same claims that the bike groups do over here, the clubs do over here, that you know, they're just a social club and blah 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 blah. But you know, in terms of Christiania, because they didn't have any rules. You know, they didn't have any drug laws. They didn't have any rules, right? The bike gangs basically came in and took over the motherfucking town. And this lasted for a period of time. I don't know if it was a matter of months, might have a year, maybe more than a year. I can't tell you. I really don't remember. It was some time back. But I do know this, is that they had a hell of a hard time getting them the fuck out of there. And it took some physical persuasion on the part of the anarchists. Now, it's not that anarchists are not are adverse to violence, you know, per se. You know, the difference with them is that, you know, they usually do so with a political objective. So I suppose they used a political objective in which to get these bikers out. Because if I understand correctly, law enforcement pretty much left Christiania to us, if I'm even pronouncing the community correctly, left Christiania to itself, because their argument was basically, you invited this. You know, you didn't want to have any rules, you didn't want to have any serious laws and shit, so, you know, this is what the fuck happens. And, you know, I just found that to be a motherfucker, because, you know, it was really the job of the system to protect them. But then, you know, on the flip side, they were like, well, you know, we're, you know, totally separate from the system, and we don't want shit from the system. So then when, you know, the actual criminal element came in, you know, the criminal element that a lot of people on the left, especially in North America, like to pretend doesn't exist. Totally unrealistic about that. And yeah, roll with me, because I'm going all over the place now. No, Luke, because this is one of the things about the border issue. The left has never, in the United States, I'm speaking specifically about the United States, has never really understood how to deal with contradiction, because you just ignore the contradiction. Right? You know, so when you're a total zealot, you know, if it's about race, if it's about religion, if it's about this bullshit hip-hop fucking universe, right? You know, you are less likely to allow facts to cloud your vision. You know, if anything, you're going to do everything possible to not allow facts to cloud your vision. You're going to deny facts altogether. I mean, we have a political party here in the United States, otherwise known as the U.S. Republican Party, right? And the grand old party, the GOP. And they've decided that, you know, wizardry is something that's real. And they deny that the climate is in crisis. They deny the moon landing. They believe in UFOs, but they deny the moon landing. Let me repeat that. I'm talking to somebody out there. They deny the moon landing. And you can understand why. I mean, you can understand why. What's that? No, seriously, because if you get a piece of information, or you get a couple of fucking pieces, you know, it makes you, you know, ask questions, which you should anyway. We should all be inquisitive. And then you get somebody like Alex Jones who follows up. And I don't want to diss people that have passed, but the late Bill Kasing and Renee, whoever the hell, you know, I mean, you know, they all wrote books about how the moon landing didn't happen. And when, you know, I mean, there's only a couple of things that really got me about that. And that was, and it wasn't the flag waving bit. Again, I can understand if you don't understand the science why that looks, you know, looks like it's wrong. Right? Now, if we sit here and try to explain, you know, well, all the science behind that, that'll take up most of the show. But, you know, you go ahead and DuckDuckGo it, or whatever search engine you choose to use, StartPage, whatever the fuck it is you choose to use, since I don't recommend Google, because they collect all your goddamn data. But, yeah, the others are probably collecting your data too, but, you know, at least for the time being, they haven't been proven to do that. But in any case, I'm not going to get into the whole science behind it. But what got me was, and I'm not even talking about the Van Allen radiation belt jazz either. What got me was some of the photographs. Now, those of us who have done photography to even a minor degree understand light and shadow, at least you should, because that's the whole basis of your value system when you actually take the photographs. I mean, that's what makes it interesting. But there's some really odd angles in the way that the light is dancing around up there. So, you know, I've heard different explanations. And one of the things that keeps a lot of these theories going, these conspiracy theories going, is that sometimes they don't either give an answer, or they give a very vague answer, or such a generalized answer that it doesn't really have anything to it. But then at the same time, someone doesn't understand science, even if they gave an explanation, blah, blah, blah. But I've had conversations with scientists too. You know, there was a fellow who lived in my building at one point. I forgot where I was living at the time, but it was in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, it was around here. And he admitted to me, he goes, you know, we don't really know all the time exactly every iota of information that needs to be understood about something. And he's like, you know, and so we tend to give general, like I just said, generalized and vague explanation sometimes, and especially with lay people, how can you explain anything? Because, I mean, look, I'm not stupid, but, you know, he was trying to explain some things to me, and it was really, I didn't have the education, I didn't have the background. You know, it is what it is. I've read John Nash's papers, and I admit it took me more than a year to understand his ideas surrounding game theory. Because I didn't have the education, I didn't have the necessary background. So what did I do? What did I have to do? I had to go back and basically educate myself so I could understand what the fuck I was reading. The same thing with economics. I pay attention to economics now because I was writing something at one point and I had to, you know, come to the conclusion that I really didn't understand very much about economics. I mean, I had a basic idea, but I really did not understand economics. And of course, when you start studying economics, you find out that economics is not an exact science, right? But the bottom line is, when I don't know something, I try to take the time to educate myself. So, you know, people say, oh, well, you never looked into QAnon. Yeah, I have. There's nothing there. It's bullshit. It's a hoax. Now it's become a fucking cult. The cult leader is probably, depending on who you want to believe. I mean, if you believe that the far right, it's a leftist prankster. And if you listen to a lot of folks on the left, it's a far right prankster. But either way, it's a prankster, because not one goddamn prediction has come true. Nothing. They keep saying that they come true, and what they do is they take another breadcrumb or some other bullshit fucking theory to explain why it doesn't look like it came true, even though it did come true. So, you know, these motherfuckers are this goddamn stupid. And Trump, who has no idea what the fuck Q is, QAnon, he'll use and point to anything he thinks will shore up his base. We just saw General John Kelly, the former chief of staff, who's now gone, because he just got tired of it, couldn't deal with this cat anymore, and left. He bugged out and left, and motherfucking, he's like, look, he gave up the reality of that wall shit a long time ago. You know, Mexico was not going to pay for that motherfucker. They're going to find, you know, some other goddamn way. You know, they're going to find some other goddamn way to explain this shit. And, I mean, look, he didn't take, well, actually, he still hasn't taken credit, but he didn't even mention the names, let alone the deaths of those two South American or Central American children, because I can't remember what nations they're from. He couldn't mention them other than to blame the Democratic Party for their deaths, even though it was his policy, his arrogance. But the bottom line, you know, could stay with the facts. I mean, we all know he's arrogant. That's just a given. But it's just as much of a fact as the sun is going to rise tomorrow morning. But it's his policy. He's the head of the government. The buck stops here. A Democrat said that, right? He was a racist son of a bitch. I mean, we can talk all fucking day. Yeah, he dropped a massive device, as we call them now, on from the Enola Gay. He called it an experiment, you know, on Japan, but he took credit for his own fucking administration. Trump takes credit for only the things that make him look like a big man. Did you watch him? Brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, and you spooks that come in here to listen to what I'm saying and shit. Yo, did you see him pat and point to himself? I mean, he keeps referring to himself on Twitter as your favorite president. But he talks about people with having ego problems. He has the biggest ego in the United States, probably the fucking world. Well, I mean, he's got some rivals out there. You got Duterte, you got my wife, man, who she's really having issues with this shit because she's a Christian Palestinian. And just the whole idea for her of Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, calling, you know, being identified and encouraging the use of MBS. The encourage the use of an acronym. She's like, it's so un-Arab. It's not even funny. It's not even funny. And it's not also not funny that, and like, you know, I've talked about this many times on the broadcast. Lupe's husband is political. He's politically aware. He has interests. My wife is not. But even she, you know, can say, well, wait a fucking minute. You know, Khashoggi gets lured over there. Turns out that, you know, the CIA is saying, hey, you know, the State Department actually knew that he was under threat. He was in danger and didn't want him. And then he gets murdered, gets chopped up. His fiance sitting outside the goddamn embassy. I mean, she goes to work. They're playing the motherfucking radio. She hears the news. I mean, when the mainstream news in the United States is reporting that the Trump administration knew that Khashoggi was being set up to be murdered, set up to be assassinated, was brutally killed, dismembered in the goddamn embassy and taken out in bags out the back. You know, see, the average person is just like, what the fuck is going on? Unless you're a MAGA head. Unless you're one of these Make America First motherfuckers. Except when it comes to dealing with Saudi Arabia. Except when it comes to dealing with Russia. Except when it comes to dealing with North Korea. Except when it comes to dealing with China, right? In terms of the Trump family getting more than 50 goddamn patents in the People's Republic, Communist Republic of China. But you know, they can't stand communism. But they're doing business with a communist country. Now, we all know fucking China isn't communist, hasn't been communist, doesn't smell communist, doesn't eat communist, doesn't do a fucking thing communist any goddamn more. Okay, the ghost of Mao Zedong is just that. It's a specter that you see. But what they do now is they take an American-made match and they just light it. And the ghost goes away. You know, I mean, they're doing Christianity now. They're doing Christmas now. I mean, I got people in Taiwan. And Taiwan, of course, has this beast with the mainland. Even though people flying back and forth and doing business and bullshit all the time, on the private level, the bottom line is, you know, People's Republic of China that has always seen Taiwan as their property, even though no one ever asked the indigenous Taiwan fuckingese. See, they talk about the nationalists and shit who left with Chiang Kai-shek. Nobody talks, you know, who the people that I know, they're the descendants of those. They're the descendants of the right-wing nationalists and shit who, after the revolution, ran to Taiwan. You know, now, I mean, Hong Kong is a different situation. You had the British, you got Kowloon, right? You got the Portuguese and all that kind of shit. You know, you got that sort of, you know, Macau, right? You got that sort of thing going on. So the colonialism is different because of who occupied. But in terms of, political egos and what have you, you can't get any crazier than what's going on with Donald Trump. You just can't. You just can't. You can't. I mean, the situation I just explained, with mainland China and Taiwan, do you think Trump would understand any of that? Do you even think he knows where the fuck Taiwan is in the proximity to China? right? I mean, China, it figures in the goddamn Rohingya issue. I had a guest, George Hinson, he's a professor at the University of The Hague. I forget exactly what he does there, but you can go look it up at aboriginalradio.wordpress.com. Check out everything we have and get the RSS feed so you do not ever have to miss a broadcast. But we talked about the Rohingya and what's not being reported over here, even though you can go and look for the information yourself and find it. But he hipped, our listeners to the fact that the Chinese are running an oil pipeline through Rakhine State, where the Rohingya live, where the Rohingya are being ejected, basically, because the bottom line is they're getting in the way of this motherfucking pipeline for China. So, Aung San Suu Kyi, obviously, you know, said, fuck human rights, she's going to do business with China. So in terms of the ego, I mean, maybe she's not on on television over here. She's not on the radio over here. They're not talking about her in the news over here. But let's be honest, you got to have a hell of a goddamn ego to be a human rights activist for how many, two decades? People died for you. People went to prison for you. You know, there were a whole lot of stunts so that people knew who the fuck you were. And as soon as you got in, you got racial. And have decided that the Rohingya people don't look Burmese. So they have to go. So they have to go. Right? Because the Burmese Buddhists. Now you gotta understand how this fucks with me. Because I've been Buddhist just about. I mean, I've acknowledged Buddhism. Because it's not a religion. It's not a belief system. But god damn it. I've acknowledged Buddhism ever since I was 17 fucking years old. And then to find out that, Buddhism, even though I knew this, I mean, in, Tibet, monks murder each other all the goddamn time. I mean, the only reason that the current Dalai Lama is still alive is because he's not in Tibet. You know, I mean, they get assassinated all the time. You know, look at the fuck up. Monks murder each other all the time. They got all kinds of political schisms between those institutions over there. I don't know, so many different ways I can go with this, man. And you know, now we're looking at Trump. So to deal with the Trump situation, you know, the left is just, in the United States anyway, speaking about the U.S., it is in such a goddamn funk. It's unbelievable. And it knows that it is, but ego will not allow the DNC to say, we need to really fucking ask ourselves, what the fuck do we want? Instead of worrying about the goddamn window goddamn dressing, what is it that we want? What is it that we're fucking about? Now, Republican and Democrat, both political parties are bullshit, but you know, I get tired of these goddamn pseudo intellectual fucking arguments from people who are like, well, I mean, the Democratic Party started the Klan. Now, we've already talked about this, I don't know how many goddamn times. Oh, did I? I mentioned it the last broadcast too. Well, it needs to be said because I still hear black people talking this shit. No, the Democratic Party as a political fucking entity did not start the Klan, did not formulate the Klan. Understand the political context of what the fuck was going on. These were ex-Confederate soldiers, right? Which means that they were where in the United States? On the wrong side of the Mason-Dixon line, right? Who in the South, in the American South, in the American Gothic goddamn South, what political party was strongest down there? The Democrats. Before all of this, it was never, you might find a Democratic politician or firebrand from that time period, you know, before Reconstruction, that justified slavery. But as far as I can understand, and if I'm wrong, then email me here. What's that? Yeah, or they can come on the show and discuss it. Email me here at number4thworldradio@gmx.pt. I say it again. number4thworldradio@gmx.pt. 4thworldradio@gmx.pt. You can come on the show and discuss it. if you think I'm wrong, you want to come on the show and embarrass me, you know, if that's what you're about, because because people have tried that too, right? And really, they didn't have anything to say. They just wanted to push their motherfucking agenda, you know, whatever the fuck that was. And again, that's where I'm going to. People have agendas and don't even realize that they have agendas, and then think they got to walk around with an agenda. You know, so it's like, well, I'm all about black people. That's my agenda. Okay, so what does that mean? You're all about black people, but you're believing Alex Jones. Right? If you're all about black people, why are you okay with Beyonce? Because it's all about black people making cannon fodder of the Black Panther Party doing that Super Bowl halftime shit that had no political value whatsoever. Why are you okay with that, but you're still slamming Colin Kaepernick? Not for what Colin Kaepernick is doing during the protests, but because Colin Kaepernick is mixed. But it's all about black people. See, these are contradictions I'm really getting into fucking discussions with people about. Colin Kaepernick does the Me Too, not the Me Too, he does the take a knee bit, and who gives a goddamn anymore? The season is going to start soon, right? Or did it start already? I'm not into sports. I don't even know. But every black fucking person I asked, I said, yo, we should boycott the NFL. Motherfuckers are like, man, what the fuck is wrong with you? I'm like, do you want to hurt racism? You want to put a fucking dent in racism? Help brother man out and boycott the goddamn NFL. Nope. Absolutely not. Can't do it. Won't do it. Not happening. Fuck you, Uncle Tom. That's all you are. You want to stop football? Fuck you. Yeah. You want your liberation. You're ready to fight the gays. You're ready to fight the white hipsters and shit. You know, you're ready to fight the Mexicans. You're ready to, you know, to go to war with every goddamn buddy, but you won't boycott the motherfucking NFL. And that's the other thing I wanted to talk about, since I just mentioned Twitter. I already mentioned Twitter. I was thinking about it. Chris Rock. This happened before the holidays. Now, I didn't see the clip. I don't want to. It's still on YouTube, I suppose. But from what I understand, Jerry Seinfeld had to defend black people because Chris Rock wouldn't. And what was it? Louis C.K. and who else? You don't even know what I'm talking about. I thought you saw it on Facebook. Well, you quit Facebook. That's right. To go on another tangent. She says she doesn't know what I'm talking about. I know what I'm talking about. I saw and I reposted it, frankly, without even seeing it, which is wrong. But I trusted who I was reposting, you know, and you know, like Keith Boykin and what have you. And apparently they were going back and forth with nigga on this program. Louis C.K., he's part Latino, part Mexican or something. And, white Mexican, I suppose, right? And, cause, you know, actually there's lots of Mexicanos that look just like him, but in South America in general. But what I'm saying is, I suppose, you know, a lot of people, if they find out that they have something not European in their background, and they can call themselves nigger and use it. Well, they were going back and forth, and Chris Rock was just sitting there, I guess, grinning or laughing or whatever the fuck it was. And, Seinfeld was like, I'm not comfortable with this. You kind of know what you're doing. Now, look, comedy is a motherfucker, and comedy should be loose, but comedy should have a fucking point. At this particular political time and place for social political comment that is relevant to what the fuck is happening. Not just to insult people for the sake of insulting motherfuckers. See, I have no truck. I take no truck with that bullshit. And which is why, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, that's why you don't, fuck with black comics. I'm like, it's all they're doing is fucking insulting people, man. It's just low brow comedy. I mean, how many goddamn feces jokes can you make? You know? After a while. Tell me, you know, say something intelligent. Make me motherfucking think. You know, there's plenty. I mean, Eddie Izzard. I mean, goddamn. You know, it's just silly, the shit that people come up with to excuse, you know, their desire to be unsophisticated, their desire to be in the gutter, you know, their desire to fucking take half-ass bullshit. That is what Trump represents. That is what all of the fascists, Modi, Duterte, you know, Bolzano, whatever the fuck his name is. Bolinazaro, whatever the fuck it is down there. I don't care. You know, let's just, you know, be done with this. I don't give a fuck. But he's down there in Brazil while Lula's sitting in prison. Dilma Rousseff, who tried to play both ends against the fucking middle, you know, because I wasn't happy with a lot of shit that she was doing either. And the Obama administration was really heavy-handed with their bullshit on her. And she basically bucked to the pressure where Lula did not. Right? So when you look at what's happening in Brazil and then you see what's happening in the United States, is that it's a mirror. Brazil has always been a mirror. That's where the other majority of black people are in the Americas, is in Brazil. Right? And, you know, the discrepancies in terms of education and housing and poverty and medical care, it's horrible. But they've been under the thumb of the United States for decades. So if Black Agenda Report wants to talk about something, why don't they talk about Brazil in relation to, you know, in relationship to the United States? That they've been popping up and propping up the motherfucking Russian government as much as possible. I'm not kidding about that. I'm not kidding about that. I mean, don't believe me. Just go over to their website. Don't believe me at all. Just go to their website and investigate it for yourself. And you'll see articles which, I mean, none of this is new. How the U.S. spent billions to change the outcome of elections around the world. A review. Okay, that's true. But in terms of the Russian government, the argument that they're making is, well, it doesn't really motherfucking matter that the Russians are fucking, if they, well, first off, they deny that the Russians have anything to do with it at all. I mean, the last direct thing that I saw from them, they're making the argument that Russiagate was the scam that will not die, which is, you know, fucking ridiculous when they were limiting black people and their fucking right to vote. They were helping the Republicans create an atmosphere that prevented black people from going to the polls. Flat out telling black folks with fake fucking black power websites, don't vote. And if you do vote, vote for Jill Stein. You know, the white woman who has big oil investments, big energy investments, and all other types of bullshit that she talks against.
A new year is dawning, and it's been 2 years since investigations began into the so-called Russiagate scandal. But Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly says the main charge against President Trump, WikiLeaks, and the Russian government remains unproven.
There's still no evidence of collusion between Trump and the Russian government. We have people who have pled guilty to a variety of crimes, such as Paul Manafort. He's guilty of tax fraud. Michael Cohen paid off a porn star and was involved with an unrelated matter of some taxi medallion scam in New York City. Michael Flynn did lie to the FBI about meeting the Russian ambassador, but he did so because Israel asked him to. They wanted to talk about an upcoming vote at the UN. So we have people who are involved in various levels of crookedness, but nothing tied to this charge of collusion. No proof that the Russians were Julian Assange's source in publishing the DNC emails. So they have to keep going back using the media to spread their stories. And today, another story broke, a McClatchy papers, that allegedly some intelligence sources say that Michael Cohen was in Prague and met with Russians. Now, he keeps denying he was ever in the Czech Republic, and I recall that he had, in fact, turned over his passport to a journalist. And it's not, to make a long story short, it's not possible for him to have been there at the time that it is claimed. So they are, unfortunately, well, because the evidence shows that this claim of collusion is unproven, they have to find new ways to keep whipping up this story. And by they, I mean the Democratic Party and the corporate media and their friends in the intelligence agencies. Having started this lie, they cannot let it go. It is a way for Democrats, they think, to get votes, to keep talking about Russia. So I believe, unfortunately, every time something is disproven, it actually prolongs the story because they cannot admit that they have carried out this scam for so long.
Her and her husband hold stock and motherfucking, you know, all kinds of financial connections to that bullshit. And she was in Russia. She was sitting there with Michael Flynn, Kislyak, who else? Putin, right? But she's like, it's no big deal. I was going there to represent myself. It's no big deal that I sat there with all these fucking political criminals. You know, it's no big deal. Who are supported by the far right in Russia. Who are supported by the far right leaning of Russian Orthodox Church. Who are supported by the gangster element over there, Dvory, right? So, you know, no big deal. She was a fucking hypocrite. And what happened to that money, the millions that she collected to challenge the election? What happened with that? Jill Stein is a fucking phony. The Greens in the United States are a fucking joke. Period. They also ran Roseanne Barr at one goddamn point, remember? And she's this racist. I mean, she claims to be Jewish, but then she's baking Jewish cookies and shit wearing a fucking Hitler costume. So it's like, you know, what the hell is going on here, folks? The Nation of Islam is doing Scientology. The founder of Scientology was a white racist who wrote science fiction novels and shit and ran with a fucking a devil worshiper, Jack Parsons, the same cat that developed Genesis to take off. He was a Satanist, ladies and gentlemen. I thought the Nation of Islam was doing everything possible to fight the devil. But they've adopted the white devil's fucking religion, both of them. Oh, they can talk all that shit about, well, you know, the Bible comes from, you know, whatever, man. You got it the same way the rest of us over here fucking got it. You got it through white people after they co-opted it. The Nation of Islam is a bullshit motherfucking cult, man. And see, and again, this is where, you know, the minds of black people are being fucking pulled and shredded. The Nation of Islam is a goddamn joke. Since the end of Malcolm, the Nation of Islam hasn't been worth a fucking dime. I mean, when I was a kid, it still had a little something going to it, man. You could go to your bakery, you could go to your fish store, you could go to your market, whatever the hell that was run by the Nation. But they got sloppy, and they fucking all went the fuck out of business. Because the bean pies and shit, the quality goddamn went down. Shit got sloppy. And in fucking Philly, you had a fucking mosque that was basically a fucking headquarters for a goddamn criminal organization that was using the Nation of Islam as a cover. Now, there's all kinds of good points that, you know, we could point to, be it the Nation of Islam, be it the Catholic Church, and da-da-da-da-da. But at the same time, the Catholic fucking Church, like I said, you know, I was raised Catholic. I didn't have problems as an altar boy. My priest was a good man. But that doesn't mean that the organization fucking deserves to exist. The organization shouldn't exist at all. On that basis alone, no, stop the religion? No. But the organization, the Catholic Church, should not fucking exist. It has no right to fucking exist. And it's hypocritical that people fucking continue to allow it to fucking exist while they're yelling Pizzagate. You know, yelling Pizzagate, but you don't say anything about Trump and his connections to Jeffrey Epstein. You know, you just keep talking about the Clintons, but you don't talk about Alan Dershowitz and his connections to Epstein. You keep talking about the Clintons. You keep talking about Uranium One when there was no goddamn scandal. You know, I mean, how many fucking, another goddamn investigation into Uranium One just ended last week or whatever the fuck. I mean, there's nothing. 27, was it? That was the number you gave me, right? 27 different investigations in throughout her political life. And the one thing I will fucking call her on, like, and I did. The super predator shit was racist as hell. The bring them the heel shit was racist as hell. And Black Lives Matter still tried to cotton her, right? They still tried to make a deal with her through all of that shit. Now, there were Black Lives Matter activists that continued to challenge her, but Black Lives Matter itself as an organization that tried to form an organization, they tried to forget all about that and let bygones be bygones, because we're going to hook our fucking cart to Hillary Clinton. Because, you know, it's a woman's time and it's her time, rather than putting in the woman that should be in, who's really representing our motherfucking interests, instead of putting in somebody familiar. Now, if you want to get on her, like I said, for the super predator shit, I'm ahead of you. You want to get on her for the bring them to heel thing, I'm down. You want to get on her for lying about sniper fire with Bosnia, you know, in Bosnia, you know, cause after Sheryl Crow and the Sinbad comedian blew her motherfucking fib, you know, let's do that. But if you're going to list her and line her shit up and the Clinton Foundation or what the fuck is happening with the Trump family, you're crazy. I mean, the Trump Foundation just got New York State, right? Just got dismantled legally by the fucking attorney general in the state of New York, because they said they couldn't find one goddamn thing they did for anybody other than their fucking selves. So, no. I mean, look. Trump started off his first Twitter fucking thing in promoting his campaign when running for president was himself, an American flag, and an image of the fucking Waffen SS. And, you know, the mainstream media and the general goddamn public let him fucking get away with that. And fuckers like Tim Scott let him get away with that. And Michael Steele let him get away with that. And Mia Love let him get away with that. And Michelle Malkin let him get away with that. And Nikki Haley let him get away with that. And Jason Chaffetz let him get away with that. Did I miss anybody? I can fucking keep talking about all the Republicans and the Democrats that let him get away with that. He told you who he was from the fucking beginning. The Klan endorsed him. What the fuck more do you need? He's called for the release of Tommy Robinson from prison. I don't know what his case is right now, but Tommy Robinson is the number one goddamn neo-Nazi in Britain. And he has called for his motherfucking to be left alone, that he is a victim. That Tommy Robinson is a victim while he's out here calling for physical violence against Muslims and white power across Europe. But what am I talking about? Steve Bannon is over there spreading that bullshit. And I got black people over here defending this, trying to explain this away. And then you got other black folks that figure, well, you know, any black person would do. So let's back Cory Booker, even though Cory Booker seems to not have any problems with Republicans whatsoever. There was not one black person in politics at this point right now. I mean, you got Barbara Lee, you got Maxine Waters, but you understand what I'm saying? They got no fucking support. You have the Congressman James Brown in Texas, who actually went as far as to conduct. He started talking, let's do impeachment. Not one Democrat would fucking support him. Not one black fucking person I'm aware of who even knew about it was willing to support him. Because remember, you know, you can't... You know, the NFL? Oh, wow, man. I mean, you know, boycott the NFL? I mean, you know, come on, man. Right? So what do we have now? We have a situation where Colin Kaepernick stood up. It was totally pushed out of his goddamn means of employment and is now taking money from Phil Knight to promote Nike, when Nike only wanted him because of the fucking controversy. In the meantime, Phil Knight and the Nike organization is giving as much as is legally fucking possible to the pro-Trump Republicans. And they've been supporting every Trump fucking measure with their dollars and their phone calls and their emails as they can. And Colin Kaepernick is taking their fucking money, because he has to make a fucking living. And then we'll say all of this shit and we'll say, oh, okay, well, you know, he had to do something. But that's funny. You know, black men are being told all the time they're out of work. Well, do something. Do any goddamn thing. Work in fucking McDonald's. Do any goddamn thing. These are all contradictions. I'm not pointing fingers around, but you know, if you throw a rock into a crowd of dogs, the only one that hollers is the one that gets hit. This is the Angry Indian. and you are still in 2019 listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Samantha Nock at Samiri on Twitter, halfbreedsreasoning.wordpress.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
A new report out tonight reveals that Russian disinformation teams have targeted the special counsel. Two reports commissioned by the Senate Intelligence Committee and focused on the Internet Research Agency, the Russian troll farm Robert Mueller indicted last February. According to one of them, quote, what is clear is that all of the messaging clearly sought to benefit the Republican Party and specifically Donald Trump. The goal was to reinforce tribalism, to polarize and divide, to exploit societal fractures, blur the lines between reality and fiction, erode our trust in media entities and the information environment, in government, in each other, and in democracy itself. The interference is still active and ongoing. And notably, the trolls have tried to create and amplify the narrative that the whole investigation was nonsense, that Comey and Mueller were corrupt, and that the emerging Russia stories were a weird conspiracy pushed by liberal crybabies. Who else? The online posts received nearly 264 million engagements, as they're called, across platforms. That includes likes, retweets, shares. With us to talk about this tonight and its seriousness, Malcolm Nance, veteran of Navy Intelligence, Special Ops, Homeland Security, 35 years working in counterterrorism. His latest book is called The Plot to Destroy Democracy, How Putin and His Spies Are Undermining America and Dismantling the West. Malcolm, most people, if you ask them, will say, yeah, the schools are in terrible shape, except the one my kid goes to. So as a consumer matter, I'm guessing a lot of people think, I'm too smart for this. I'm not going to go for this propaganda. That couldn't work on me. Tell us what this looks like, what it looked like in 2016, what it still looks like on our phones tonight.
Well, what it looks like is information that is flowing into your telephone. What you think that you're getting across from Facebook and all these other media sources, and of course the fake media, as Donald Trump calls it, is just a fundamental part of your day. Whether you're listening to AM radio, whether you're reading things on Twitter, or you're looking at photos on Instagram or Pinterest. What Russia has done here, and where the true brilliance of this intelligence operation comes from, is way back in the early 2000s, the Russian military conducted a strategic study and started carrying out a disinformation plan in which they said that instead of carrying out kinetic warfare against your enemies, the best thing we can do is create a disinformation frame around that nation, to the point where over time, as we are constantly tearing them apart and feeding them with false information, they would actually welcome an invasion.
It's a quote-unquote influence in Syria. So it's been mission creep all along. It has no strategic value whatsoever. And this is an impediment to ending the civil war that the West, for the most part, and its Gulf allies have pursued. And now it is time to wrap it up. Russia is front and center, though you won't hear this in the mainstream media, to come to a diplomatic solution, because Russia is the country that will have to deal with Turkey, and the Turks and the Russians, with their ups and downs, can come to some kind of conclusion where Syria remains whole and it has a government of the people. And Russia has been working very, very hard, though. Again, you wouldn't hear this in the mainstream media, where there'll be constitutional and political reform in Syria. Those are all positives. Yep. And so Donald Trump is on the right side of history. I've been watching the media. None of these people really know it. They don't know anything at all about what they're talking about. Empire is going to be America's demise. Though they all have a stake in empire, that's why they cannot pull back from it. From the both political parties to the media to the military industrial complex, even Hollywood has a stake in empire. And It is not paying. It is unaffordable. It is immoral, and for the most part, it's illegal. Donald Trump is doing the right thing, though he's paying a pretty high political cost. There may even be an attempt to impeach him over his strategic thinking when it comes to U.S. overseas commitments. It will change from Russiagate to he's a national security risk. Why not? They've tried everything else.
I mean, they've been selling. You know, the press has been acted shocked, and they're talking about him being intemperate because of the timing of it, quote unquote. But I was in the RNC in Cleveland when he said it was time to put an end to the failed policies of nation building and regime change. And nation building, quote unquote, is the official mission in Iraq and Afghanistan for better than a decade now. I mean, the regime change already took place. And the regime change is what the purpose, regardless of what, you know, niceties they've spewed out of Washington, what was driving the Syria war. And so, you know, now he is, and he says while he's doing these things, you know, these were campaign promises. I was elected to do this, and that's something to remember. I mean, there is this huge political cost because he's getting bashed everywhere for doing it, but people voted for him to do this, too, and he won the election. So there's a constituency there, but you would never know that looking at the media here. Yeah, you know, and by the way, when you talk about Europeans and their attitudes towards Trump, you know, it's the same, I guess, dichotomy that you face when you talk about Americans. For example, Macron, you know, those kind of people in Europe, those Europeans, quote unquote, will say the same thing that the Western press says about Trump and about Brexit and about all of the other phenomenon that are showing a rejection of the existing order across the board, particularly of austerity, of all of the problems that people have faced that are consequent to these wars, including, you know, massive migration into these countries and overburdening of all of the systems, etc. There's the whole officialdom, the media, everyone else is parroting the same line that the media parrots here. But the people on the ground vote for Brexit. You know, they're yellow vests. Yeah, the yellow vests in the streets now, ready to, you know, show Macron a 21st century version of a guillotine. You've had you want to start with Syriza and run through, you know, the gamut of things, even at left and right. Phenomenon, you know, with people mouthing leftist rhetoric on the one hand or rightist rhetoric on the other, if they're talking about addressing both the question of national sovereignty, because no one feels that their institutions respond to them, getting them jobs, helping them pay to live, those things resonate no matter whose mouth they come out of at the moment, because the condition of people is so desperate. And those folks that are informed about what's going on, well, they'll tell you that the people that voted for Brexit are the same, that's the same phenomenon that's got Trump elected. Well, they did vote for Brexit, and they voted for all these other things that are also being pointed to as the same phenomenon as Trump, because those people face the same conditions that workers in the United States face.
So Russia has done that to the United States, and it began way before 2016. As a matter of fact, the earliest references I have with relation to Donald Trump shows that it started back in 2011 with Maria Butina and the NRA contacts with the fundamentalist Christian right and the alt-right in the United States. Russia was pushing these disinformation themes then. Then in 2013, they stood up the Russian Federation Internet Research Agency, which built all of these memes and tropes, which became the cruise missiles of fake news and disinformation designed to do what it did today. Take one-third of the United States population and make them refuse to believe what they see before their very eyes and may have elected a president in the process.
And one of your long-held beliefs, which simultaneously breaks my heart, is that they were so good at picking apart our differences, dividing American against American, and knowing such an incredible cost-benefit analysis, it cost them nothing, knowing how to do it easily, that you won't be surprised in the end if they had American help.
Absolutely. And the cost of this mission by Russian intelligence, and that's who carried this operation out. The Russian Internet Research Agency was a subcontractor to Russian military intelligence and the FSB, Russia's national security agency. And it was done at the cost of less than a couple of cruise missiles. They now own the mindset of one third of this nation. And by doing that, they have managed to now make us not believe anything that we believed before. That diversity was an American factor which made us greater. They have played on the themes of far-right conspiracy theorists from the 1960s. The John Birch Society, a sideline group, you know, and the farthest extremes of the libertarian parties.
Donald Trump is about to enter year three of his presidency, and here's how bad it is when compiled by one enterprising journalist. Wired magazine tallied up at least 17 distinct court cases stemming from at least seven different sets of prosecutors and investigators. That does not include congressional inquiries. Our network is placing those cases under six broad categories of investigation. Russian interference in the 2016 campaign, including obstruction. Hush money payments leading to campaign finance violations. Inaugural committee spending. Misuse of charity funds involving the Trump Foundation. Foreign payments and emoluments. Clause of the Constitution. Allegations that Trump is accepting payments from foreign powers while in office. And a defamation lawsuit over a sexual assault claim. That is the case related to the accusations from a former apprentice contestant. We've been left to read this story in progress as it's laid out in all the various charging documents, sentencing documents, especially those related to Michael Cohen. They all raise questions about whether Trump could eventually be indicted. As you may know, there is that Justice Department policy against indicting a sitting president. But the man who was formerly the top government lawyer before the Supreme Court, Neil Katyal, feels the Trump case could be so unique that rule may not apply.
Southern District says you can get out of jail if you do this. He's got 3 years now. There's a real motivation to sing like crazy. He's got to do a lot of singing to get out of the 3 years. And he will say whatever he has to say. He's changed his story four or five times.
So has the president.
President's not under oath.
And will, to the best of my ability,
preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
They have amplified racism to the point where the alt-right, Steve Bannon's own creation of gamers, is now the wholly owned subsidiary of the Trump campaign, and our believers in David Duke, the Ku Klux Klan, Richard Spencer, the neo-Nazi, and Robert Spencer, the Islamophobe, to the point where they're mainstreamed. This is how effective this information warfare campaign has been carried out. And let me tell you, this report shows how they went after to suppress the African-American vote. And there is no doubt in my mind or anybody else's in the intelligence community that doesn't believe that it took American citizens to assist them in really getting down to where these voters were who needed to be suppressed. And they did it in such a fashion. One of their Twitter groups had 366,000 followers on it.
Wow.
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for intelligent aboriginals.
Please note, if you experience difficulty with a cassette, please hold it flat in the palm of your hand and slap it smartly against a hard, flat surface. If this does not work, call the customer service number shown on the package for a replacement. Discard the broken cassette.
What is the monkey hustle?
Hey, brother, what it is?
It's a funny flick. I mean, a funny flick that's downright tasty.
Chicken, pluck can.
It's booty kicking, knuckle busting action.
It better be a candy bar, nigga, because you pull it out and you sure gonna eat it.
It's dodging the man.
Hold it, you turkeys. Let me show these suckers they can't mess with the black knight.
It's doing some good in the neighborhood.
Ripping off
newspaper boxes is not our thing. Can you dig?
But most of all, the monkey hustle is.
You gotta get your righteous scam. Run it through 5 different ways on Sundays, making sure there ain't no holes in it. Mm. Then after you run it through 5 different ways, then you're ready to jump out in the street with your bad walk, your bad down dip. Yeah. You're ready for the monkey hustle. Oh, can yes. you dig it?
Yaphet Kotto, Rudy Ray Moore, Rosalind Cash, and probably some people you know. The Monkey Hustle from AIP, rated PG.
All right, all right, all right.
Parental guidance suggested.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Anarchism is not bombs, disorder, or chaos. It is not robbery and murder. It is not a war of each against all.
Tune in to Subversion 1312, the 4ZZZ Anarchy Show.
Tuesday from 9 till 10 p.m. on 102.1 FM. Or streaming 4ZZZFM.org.au.
How about trying this future on for size?
Hello, I am Susan Aglukkaq. The North has the highest incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, in the country. We also have a high rate of teenage pregnancies. High-risk behaviors, unprotected sex, lead to the spread of HIV/AIDS. It can be prevented. Learn the ways to protect yourself and others. Knowledge is power.
Yo, what's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying? For Men in Hip Hop, really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable. You know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about. It shouldn't be supported. You know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
Idle No More calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution,
to honor indigenous sovereignty,
and protect the land and water
for generations to come.
Mexicans, South Americans, all indigenous people, get inspired,
take action,
and become a part of the solution.
It's my future,
your future,
our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more. Become idle no more.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA. Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA.
This is DJ Fusion of the Fuse Box Radio Broadcast at BlackRadiosBack.com. You're now listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, another slice of real black radio for the masses. All right? Peace.
Hi, good afternoon, YouTube. I know you guys are a little puzzled by the title, and I know that there are a lot of Dr. Sebi followers out there. Actually, I was one myself. The reason why I began to question Dr. Sebi, the first red flag for me was the fact that he backed up Brother Polite. He was really, really close with Brother Polite, and Brother Polite has a lot of complaints in the community. So the fact that he was so tight with someone like that, it made me question a few things. Like, you are who you hang with. So you kind of have to question the circle of people that they're involved in. This was one thing that brought me to pause about him. Excuse me. And another thing that brought me to pause was when I was looking up the ripoff report. I was actually listening to the hugest red flag I saw was when I was listening to a interview with Baba Dick Gregory. Now, I'm really good at finding out lies. I don't see any lies. I don't see any lies in Baba Dick Gregory. And a lot of people think that he's crazy because they're too stupid to really understand what he's saying. But during this interview, which was recent, he was asked how he felt about Dr. Sebi's death. And in order to paraphrase, this is not an exact quote, he said something about he didn't know anything about the death, and he wanted to know how it was possible for a man with no education to go in the Supreme New York Court with no shoes on and get away with that. He also said that you might want to research how many people have gone to his village for treatment and actually were not treated and were not cured. No one else caught on to what Baba Dick Gregory was saying with that. I did. And I decided to research Dr. Sebi. And this is what I found. This is the ripoff report. You guys can definitely find this on the deep web. Don't be scared, because fear is the reason why you lack wisdom and knowledge today. So I'll go ahead and read this. Excuse me. It says, I was diagnosed with herpes 1 and 2 9 years ago. I was then diagnosed with HIV 4 years ago, which is now full-blown AIDS. As I held off on using traditional medication and Western medicine for Dr. Sebi, since he said he can cure me, I've also suffered from lower intestinal ulcers that have ruined my life because of the virus. I was so depressed I couldn't face the humiliation of going to a clinic to get medication for the rest of my life. Plus, I had heard that the cure was available. For years, I've searched for a cure to totally eradicate the virus. A close friend recommended Dr. Sebi because Sebi touts publicly that he can cure any virus, AIDS, cancer, diabetes, anything. Because his treatment attacks and kills the cell, which is all mucus related, Dr. Sebi has tons of lectures on YouTube that I've watched, and he constantly makes trips from Honduras to California to lecture and quote-unquote enlighten people to come to Usher Village and order his cell food products on his cell food, on his Sebi cell food website. It goes on to state, what they fail to tell you is that he won't personally be treating you. Yet, you're given to the illusion that he will. It took me 3.5 years after knowing about Sebi to do everything to raise the money to get to him, even to the point of flatlining in a hospital on the edge of death. At first, I was quoted $1,500 for a week. Then later down the line, I was so bad off wise that Dr. Sebi and his people recommended I come to Usher Village for at least 25 days at $800 a week. I had no skepticism at all that his method would work, and I truly believe Dr. Sebi was my hope, was my only hope of being cured. So I did everything to raise the money. I've seen testimonials, though none of them include someone saying he actually cured them of HIV. I still kept my faith in his abilities. I didn't want any source of negativity to taint me and my belief in Dr. Sebi. Fast forward to 3.5 years later, to 2015. It took everything out of me to get to Honduras, but I got there. The first disturbing red flag was when I wrote his daughter, Salma, with specific questions, and response I got was real vague. Some questions were not answered at all, which let me know Salma didn't even fully read the email and receive it in the love and humility in which it was sent. The responses were short, and it seemed like she was on automatic pilot. When I was sent, the responses were so short, it seemed like she was on automatic pilot. When I got to Honduras, my consultation didn't start till 2 days after being there, yet I had to pay that full week. Salma prescribed me meds, and I was off on my journey to what I thought was good health. I did the bath, kettle water, and sauna every day, and took all my herbs, those which were provided at least. And I did my best to stay stress-free, which ended up being impossible. Problems arose as I realized, as did everyone else there at Usha. That Usha village is completely disorganized. Salma is never in the office, locked up in her room, and doesn't care to be bothered. Salma only cares about the day you need to pay. You have to ask 4 times for your needs to be met. Even then, Salma will forget to apologize with excuses when confronted. They have one nurse, Evelyn, to take care of the whole village in the daytime, who can't keep up with everyone and constantly forgets. The 2 night nurses don't speak English. The only consistency is that people bang on your door to get your blood pressure, which makes no sense if they are contributing to your stress by not getting you proper herbs. Some days I got repeats of the same bitter drink. One time someone brought me what was supposed to be marijuana tea, but it wasn't. It was bitter morning drink because it turned out that the kitchen staff put something in the wrong pot. My herbs were never administered consistently, which took away from the probability that I'd leave cured, as I was told, if I just came for 21 days. I was so stressed because I kept having to chase after Salma and Evelyn, only to get minimal to no results. Evelyn and Salma were nice, however. All the apologies in the world can't make up for me leaving uncured and in worse health than I came. That's the problem. Salma does everything with a smile, but it's fake. She isn't even mentally there. They have the nerve to try to double charge my credit card for services not rendered. These people are money hungry. Dr. Sebi was conveniently gone the day I arrived. The truth is that Salma just doesn't genuinely care about anyone else's well-being. There's a client named Miss Beverly who's been at Usha for 4 months and can't even walk because they have neglected to treat her properly. She asked me to push up in a broken wheelchair to the bath and stuff, but I'm too sick for all that and shouldn't have to. It's not my job, but when what they gave her in addition to the mushrooms apparently made her even more sick. Miss Beverly was worse off months later than when she arrived at Usha and was actually able to walk. I myself left Usha much worse than when I arrived too because of the overall neglect. Nobody at Usha is attentive to anyone's needs and is very unprofessional. What kind of sense does it make to hire primarily Spanish-speaking staff to serve only English-speaking clients? It was very frustrating, and I'm depressed of how anticlimactic my trip to Usha ended up being. They lie and tell you the nurses know English, but they know minimal to the point it's ineffective. They know phrases, but can't keep ongoing dialogue to identify your issue. What let me know Dr. Sebi was part of this whole cure scam is that the day I left him a letter with his nephew, Michael, who ignores me when I try to contact him now that I'm gone, and at his front door with my phone number on it, and he never acknowledged our call. Apparently, he is retired. But I found out last minute when I was there in Honduras. But yet he still lives on the premises of the village, letting his daughter rip people off. While he corrals new victims with his lectures. And of course, when I was leaving, I was told Dr. Sebi was coming in that same day. Dr. Sebi is a fraud and clearly beyond a shadow of a doubt, a marketing scheme, playing on the hopes of desperate people like me trying to get healthy. He raises fear about all the foods we eat using partly valid facts and how these foods aren't good in order to create demand for his products. However, the outrageous prices he charges keep anyone with any regular income from affording it. He swears he wants to help our people, cure our black people, but sets prices so high that the average working class person just can't afford it. Plus, the staff he hires just doesn't care and does everything so half-assed, both at USHA in Honduras and the California office. What is most disheartening is how misled I and so many others told me that they were. Sabi and his staff tell you that you can be cured of whatever your disease is over the phone to get you to spend the money. Once you get there, then it's a lot of verbal backpedaling. And the real truth comes out that was stated to me by Sama and Pablo at different times. Being that it's a lifestyle, not a cure, it's an ongoing process. And to just stay on the urge to feel okay, not that I'd be cured, that there are no guarantees. I would not have come to USHA had I known I was just a mere glorified detox with no guarantees. They charge $1,500 a month for the package I need in their California office. I'm like, well, damn, I could just get in the HIV meds and be funded by the government rather than do the same regular monthly lifestyle regimen at $1,500 hard cash. I mean, it's just disgusting how greedy these people are. That's why several clients who were at USHA snuck out and left prematurely without paying because they were not treated properly either. I too left early because after the last nurse forgot my liquid AMBA, which I needed, and because she forgot I was worse, I was done because the chronic diarrhea made my ulcers worse to the point I couldn't sit, eat, or hardly walk. And I had to be rushed to a hospital for an emergency operation as soon as I arrived back in state because I was bleeding internally. Allegedly, celebrities have come here and been cured. Left Eye Lopez of TLC was an advocate, but that was a different time, years ago, when this ghetto hood rat Sama wasn't left to run the village and perhaps Sabi actually cared and was not yet corrupt. Dr. Sabi personally treated Left Eye because of her celebrity status. But if you're a regular civilian like me, then you get neglected. I was promised Sabi would be there when I came to USHA, and that was a lie. The past customer reviews on YouTube are from 6 years ago, and nobody ever says that he cured them of HIV. Everyone says how their overall energy and health improved, but the hard credibility of actually curing and eradicating the incurable diseases are not there. Hell, I could get a bunch of clever energy boosting stuff here in the USA. At first, I was going to keep my thoughts to myself, but because I'm now on my deathbed wasting away, I have nothing to lose. I hold Dr. Sabi and this whole represent him fully responsible for my demise and declining health. None of the other clients that expressed disdain for Sabi have taken the time to spread the word out of pure laziness, but not me. There are a few other blogs of people's bad experiences at USHA Village, but my review is more detailed and obviously recent. If someone does bad business, people have the right to know and be informed. If I can shine a light on a fraud like Dr. Sabi and his whole corrupt family, then good. Considering that again, so many others at the village left disappointed and pissed off, Dr. Sabi ripped me off and others. When I was at USHA Village, everyone had complaints that this was not what they were sold me. And I've now seen online other complaints of how USHA Village is not the disease-curing, health-restoring place that it claims to be. It's a ghost in the shell. If someone tries to get you to go run, Dr. Sabi, I am so heartbroken and ashamed of you. This report was posted on Ripoff Report on 5/29/2015. At approximately 9:15 p.m., and it is a permanent record located here. I will definitely go ahead and leave the link in the description box. excuse me. I also have a theory about Left Eye. Hear me out on this, right? People say that Left Eye knew that she was going to die, and people say that Left Eye was killed because she was going to spread the word about Dr. Sabi's good words, right? Well, in her last interview, I don't recall her mentioning Dr. Sadie's name. I don't. And I find it quite interesting that if this man was responsible for saving her life, that and a lot of people said that she knew she was going to die. So if she knew she was going to die, why wouldn't she big Dr. Sadie up during her last statement? That would make sense. If she knew she was going to die, why wouldn't you big him up as your last words in that video before you left? Now, they said the left eye was the only person to die out of seven people in a vehicle. That sounds very odd to me. Now, a lot of theories are saying that people feel Left Eye was killed because she was going to spread her good works and she had such a big platform. Well, guess what? Michael Jackson was 20 times bigger than any Left Eye. Michael Jackson was 20 times bigger than 100 Left Eyes, okay? And he was able to spread the word around just fine. So I don't believe that's what happened. I don't believe that she was killed or got into an accident or it was made to look like an accident because she was going to tell about those good works. I think she was killed because she saw something that they did not want her to know. That's what I think. It's the only fucking thing that makes sense. I have common sense. Now, why would Baba Dick Gregory say to look at this man and to question how many people were cured? Why would he say that? What is he pointing at? Why did no one point that out or do a video about it but me? Was I the only one that caught on to what Baba Dick Gregory was saying about Dr. Sadie? Was I the only one? But yeah, I can't prove that theory about Left Eye, but I believe Left Eye was killed because she knew something or she had saw something concerning Dr. Sabin. And apparently Dr. Sabin didn't work because he sued Michael Jackson. Dr. Sabin sued Michael Jackson because he didn't pay for services rendered. Apparently Dr. Sabin had cured Michael Jackson from painkillers. We all know that's bullshit because he was still addicted to painkillers. So maybe he felt like he shouldn't have to pay him because the quote unquote cure did not work. But like I said, you guys are more than welcome to leave your comments, leave your rebuttals. If you have anything to say, that's your business. But my thing is this right here. I believe whoever wrote this statement, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Thank you, ma'am. I really appreciate you writing this because for someone to take time out of their day, the sick, this man said he's on his deathbed and he had too many specifics to be on. So for this man to take the time out of his day, basically as his last dying fucking words, to tell you what he's going through, and for anyone to doubt him, you should be ashamed. You should be ashamed. Why would this man spend his goddamn last waking moment writing all of this info if it was not true? That's all I have to say. Leave your comments in the box.
I'm a new breed of American with quite a lot to say. As patriotic and religious as you get. I'm a brand new kind of Christian in the good old USA, and you don't know what to make of me quite yet. You liberal folks are just too analytical. You're called the intellectual elite. You like to use big words like hypocritical, just because my words and actions hardly meet. Well, welcome to Jesus land, where we made George Bush the president, and now we can command that the people of this country live exactly as we planned. Welcome to Jesus land. Just look on any dollar bill. It says in God we trust, so we ask his help in everything we do. Now we got freedom of religion. I reckon that means that we must tolerate the atheist and Jew. But Jesus is the man and our salvation, and every war we wage is in his name. We think his Bible should be taught in every nation, and we'll bomb anyone who doesn't feel the same. Welcome to Jesus land, where we all love thy neighbor if thy neighbors understand. We won't let too many Mexicans across the Rio Grande. Welcome to Jesus land. W's a married man, and Laura is his wife. Of their family values and beliefs we sing. They oppose a woman's right to choose because they're both pro-life. An execution, well, that's another thing. George goes to church where he'll sing from his hymnal, 'cause Jesus once protected him from harm. But if you're a convicted death row criminal, he's been known to stick a needle in your arm. Welcome to Jesus' land, where that Moses guy says, try to pry this rifle from my hand. The Prince of Peace don't want my AK-47 to be banned. Welcome to Jesus' land. Rush Limbaugh is the people's voice, 'cause we sure like to listen. He's a moral and a real straight-talking guy, who says crack-smoking addicts should all go straight to prison. We don't care that when he said it, he was high. O'Reilly is another moral beacon. That married man got no spin in his zone. He's always right, politically speaking, once he's finished talking dirty on the phone.
Shut up!
Welcome to Jesus' land, where we see the Lord in every Walmart, Sears, and Disneyland. And where some may turn the other cheek, we draw lines in the sand. Welcome to Jesus' land. Yeah, in Jesus' land, everyone knows better, but it's not a place you liberal folks can find. You see, it's not a state that's red or even redder. Now, Jesus' land is just a state of mind. Jesus' land is here to stay. Don't judge me by the way I live, just live by what I say. It's Jesus' will to build a neo-Christian USA. Welcome to Jesus' land. Welcome to Jesus' land.
Hey, this is Ra Lamada.
And Donna from Exile.
And you're listening to a
Creative Commons licensed podcast.
Word.
Would you like to hear the lie that judges tell jurors every day?
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
In a criminal case, the judge instructs the jury, you decide the facts, but you jurors must apply to those facts the law as I explain it. And if the prosecution has proven the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must return a verdict of guilty. The problem with this instruction? It's not true. It's not true at all. And the judge well knows that, but most jurors don't. Jury nullification, the right of jurors to say no, to just say no to a prosecution, was central to the Bill of Rights. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson famously believed that jurors' right to nullify was central to democracy. Writing in the Champion magazine recently, criminal defense attorney Patrick Barone cautions that care must be taken when considering nullification because juries can use that authority to enhance and augment the power of the elite rather than to limit it. But, Barone continues, jury nullification can and should be a critical limitation on legislatures bent on promulgating and judges bent on enforcing ever more overreaching criminal laws. The take-home lesson here, criminal juries should know of their right to nullify because that power can constitute liberty's last defense.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union because freedom can't defend itself.
Missy Elliott for the Black AIDS Institute.
HIV happens to us more than it does anybody else, which is why we should all get tested, because if we don't step up, then nobody will.
Get informed, get tested, get treated, and get involved. For more information, call the Black AIDS Institute at 213-353-3610. That's 213-353-3610. Or online at www.blackaids.org.
Hello, this is a message to the so-called New Black Panther Party, which resides in the United States of America. As an American citizen, I ask that you all immediately disband and stop what you are doing, which is misrepresenting an organization and a culture that you do not understand. As the child of a Black Panther, I was raised to understand that the ideals of a Black Panther shall live on. However, the physical representation of a Black Panther can and will be oftentimes misrepresented and imitated. These gentlemen are Black Panthers, and they also have the original mindset of a Black Panther, which is to ensure truth, justice, and equality for every single tax-paying American citizen, regardless of the color of their skin or their ethnicity. God bless you, and power to the people.
I'm so thirsty for revolution. I'm so crazy about the people. We're going to stand together. We're going to have a Black army, a Mexican-American army, an alliance in solidarity. We're going to have some progressive whites, all of us. And we're going to march on this pig power structure, and we're going to say, stick them up, motherfucker. We come for what's ours. Power to the people. Thanks, brother.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
We are the Ku Klux Klan. We hate niggers, we hate Jews, we hate faggots, and we hate specs. We don't have to have a reason to hate. People need to get off your ass and wake up. This is America.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
You continue to be unafraid of this man.
Yeah, I'd like to say something right here. You know, Cassius Clay, yes.
Why do you want to say Cassius Clay when Howard Cosell and everybody is calling you Muhammad Ali? Now, why you got to be the one of all people who's color to keep saying Cassius Clay?
Howard Cosell is not the one's going to fight you. I am.
You're making it really hard on yourself now.
Well,
why don't you keep the thing in the sport angle? Why don't you call me my name, man?
Well, what's your name? You told me your name was Cassius Clay a few years ago.
I never told you my name was Cassius Clay. My name is Muhammad Ali, and you will announce it right there in the center of that ring after the fight if you don't do it now.
For the benefit of this broadcast, him, all right?
You just acting just like an old Uncle Tom. Another Floyd Patterson. I'm going to punish you.
Let me tell you something, man. You ain't got no...
Back off of me.
Don't call me no Uncle Tom.
That's what you are, Uncle Tom.
Why are you going to call me Uncle Tom? I ain't doing nothing.
You heard me? Just back off of me.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, as the two contestants prepare for battle right now.
Back off of me, man. Back off of me, man.
Another interview has been recorded for posterity as the two gentlemen continue to promote the fight.
Uncle Tom.
Perfect, that's it. Come on. Keep shooting.
You can promote fights now. That's it.
You're listening to the Angry and Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
In October, Conservative candidate Bolsonaro won the Brazilian presidential election with 55% of the vote. This is a surprising shift for a country previously run by the Workers' Party from 2003 to 2016. And with its use of hateful rhetoric around marginalized groups and the violence this has already led to on the streets, alarm bells have been ringing in the human rights world. I'm Niusha Bastani.
And I'm Max Curtis. From the University of Cambridge and the Center of Governance and Human Rights, this is Declarations. So, everyone's asking, how did Bolsonaro win? What does this mean for Brazil's future? But his victory also raises more systemic questions, not just about the rise of far-right parties globally, but also about the legacy of Brazil's not-so-dated dictatorship and the lack of intergenerational memory about authoritarian human rights violations, which Bolsonaro seems to condone and maybe even praise. Some of the most significant resistance was led by women. So, in this episode, we're taking a hard look at the role of memory and gender in the rise of Brazil's far-right, and in particular, what this means for the country's most marginalized groups.
So, our guest today, who we're lucky to have to help us make sense of all this, is Dr. Malu Gatto. Her work explores the gender dynamics of political behavior, representation, and policymaking, with a focus on Latin America, especially Brazil. She's a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Zurich, with a PhD from Oxford, And this coming year, she'll be an assistant professor of Latin American politics at UCL, University College London's Institute of the Americas. Thanks for joining us, Malu.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm really excited to be here today.
Great. So where should we start?
Okay, so let's start with some context because there's obviously a lot happening. This has been all over in the news. So could you just contextualize for our listener what has been happening maybe in the immediate lead up to the elections?
Okay, so actually I'll just take us a little bit further back to give you a bit of a broader context, because to understand these elections, I think it's also important for us to understand what happened in the previous elections. So I would say that all of this started really in 2014. So in 2014, we held presidential general elections in Brazil, and Dilma Rousseff won for a second time. But at that time, she already won by a very small margin of 3 percentage points. And she won against the PSDB candidate, Aécio Neves. Now, when we think about Brazil's recent democratic history, this was a very traditional election because we had the PT, in other words, the Workers' Party, against the PSDB in the second round of elections. And this has been more or less how politics, at least at the national level, has been structured in Brazil, the PT versus the PSDB, so center-right versus center-left. But we could already feel at that point in time the polarization increasing in Brazil. We also saw this polarization being taken to the streets, right? So we start actually with street protests in 2013. We see discontent spreading throughout the country. And almost immediately after Dilma takes office, her presidency is challenged. And, you know, right after, I mean, in December 2015, so she takes office on January 2015. And in December 2015, the official proceedings for her impeachment begin. In the midst of all this, we have Operation Car Wash ongoing. And this, of course, is the corruption investigation that is implicating some of Brazil's most important politicians and businessmen, and involving some of Brazil's biggest companies like Odebrecht and Petrobras. And so the country at that time was already facing multiple crises, right? Dilma never was able to really take office in a context in which she could govern. And so the economy was also suffering. And so the impeachment proceedings start in December 2015. And by August 2016, she is impeached officially. Her then vice president, Michel Temer from the PMDB, takes office. And he was already not a very popular figure. And his approval ratings keep on decreasing, reaching 2% approval ratings in the country. And so from that context, you can already get a feeling of rejection of traditional elites, widespread corruption, and already also getting a feeling about not very great economic scenario, right? And so like now let's fast forward to this year's election. And what we have at this point is neither the PT nor the PSDB, who had been the traditional parties to compete for the presidency, having any natural candidates for the presidency. And we also have, as I mentioned, this crisis of representation in which elites of both of these parties are not trusted as they were before. So we have the PT who nominates Lula. And of course, as you know, Lula then went on to also be tried as part of the Operation Car Wash. And then he was sentenced to 12 years in prison for money laundering and passive corruption. And he turned himself in April 2018, but after having already started the campaign. And Lula, of course, who was Brazil's president from 2003 to 2010, had very large popular support across the country, but especially in the Northeast. So the fact that he was sent to prison already made a very large part of the population question the electoral process in and of itself. So nothing about these elections were easy. So he turned himself in April 2018, but he continued to campaign as the PT's candidate for the presidency until his nomination was disqualified by the electoral courts in August. There were a lot of challenges, a lot of people who were, on the one hand, dissatisfied with traditional elites, but also dissatisfied with the institutions, questioning the institutions, both the electoral institutions, but more broadly, the institutions, the political institutions, even the judiciary, about their fairness in Lula's sentence, etc. And in the midst of all of this, we also have high rates of unemployment. So right before the election, we have unemployment reaching 12%, with 13 million Brazilians being unemployed. We also have violence going through the roof, with 62,000 homicides a year. And so we have a crisis of institutions and representation. We have an economic crisis, and we have a crisis of public safety. So a lot of political scientists have been talking about this as the perfect storm. And so in that context, we have, as I mentioned, these traditional elites losing support. And Bolsonaro, who had been a congressman for almost three decades, coming forward to present himself as the solution to this crisis, but also as an outsider. And he had never occupied executive office, nor had he been a very prominent figure in Congress. And so he did present himself as this anti-corruption figure, as this outsider, but also as someone who would have the solution to Brazil's public safety crisis, which was one of the main items of the agenda. And so that's, you know, there was a lot going on, but I hope I have been able to give you a little bit of the context under which these elections took place.
Yeah, that sounds like sort of a bizarre, perfect storm for someone like Bolsonaro to, you know, to take power.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, even the word impeachment is contested in Brazil. And so a lot of the PT supporters actually call it a coup and others call it an impeachment. But what we see from this process is that actually it wasn't the people who were the most involved in enacting this coup or this impeachment process that benefited from Dilma's removal from office.
So it wasn't like Bolsonaro who launched this impeachment and then won because of it. It was like an entirely different group of politicians.
Yeah. So, I mean, the main parties that were leading this process were the PSDB and especially the PMDB. And what we see is that actually both the PMDB and the PSDB also lost considerable power in these elections. And we see that by their extensive reduction in the number of seats in the legislature. So what we see in this election, even though we've been talking a lot about it being as an anti-PT election, it was really more of an anti-system election than an anti-PT election, right? And so the traditional parties really lost. Bolsonaro's party, that was a small party, gained the second largest number of seats in Congress this time around. And so we're seeing this anti-system force that this election actually represented.
And that's kind of classic, right, in that, at least in the immediate context that you've given, well, not immediate, but let's say the past, since 2013, the context you've given us, this disillusionment with institutions, disillusionment with the political elite, that's something we're seeing with the far right in multiple locations. But then I guess what's also really interesting about Brazil is that Bolsonaro has been kind of reaching into the farther past and kind of presenting as maybe some part of Brazil's past, praising the dictatorship as some kind of, you know, solution. And even though he's kind of gone back and forth on this and, you know, has recently said he's not outright advocating for authoritarianism, there's this kind of idealization of a time where things were better, right?
Yeah. So one of the interesting things about Bolsonaro is that he managed to construct this image of him that brought in the different kinds of right in Brazil. So we have the authoritarian right. We have the social conservative right. and we have the neoliberal or economic right. And he's been able to, in one way or another, bring these three rights together. Now, when we talk about the dictatorship, so I think that there are two elements or two different types of events that pertain to the collective memory that have been really important in helping Bolsonaro. On the one hand, of course, and the most obvious is the military dictatorship. And because of Bolsonaro's military background, and also because of his many comments in celebration of the dictatorship and of specific military figures, this idea has been brought up often and multiple times by both sides, both Bolsonaro supporters and as well as the opposition to Bolsonaro. So for Bolsonaro supporters, oftentimes the military dictatorship had, in terms of evoking memory, it would evoke the memory of order. And in the context of widespread violence in the country, the notion of order was particularly attractive. I mean, I think that it's important to talk about this in two ways, right? So on the one hand, the military dictatorship hasn't been too long ago. So it's just been 3 decades that Brazil has experienced democracy, right? And so since 1985. And so it hasn't been too long ago. On the other hand, it seems that the dictatorship is felt as having been too long ago, almost as if democratic institutions can now be taken for granted. Bolsonaro's relationship to the military or background in the military or even celebrations of the dictatorship do not seem to have scared many people or even to be taken very seriously, right? So there is this idea that, okay, he might celebrate the dictatorship, but we live under democratic times and we're not going to return to the dictatorship, to any kind of dictatorship. And so what we would see a lot during these elections was this idea that we first need to enact order, and then we can think about progress, which, of course, relates to the Brazilian flag, which says order and progress, right? And so this was used as a quote-unquote slogan to justify support for Bolsonaro. On the other hand, of course, Bolsonaro's opposition mentioned dictatorship very often, and his comments in celebration of the dictatorship and of torture as something that we had to be very careful about. And in thinking and emphasizing that precisely the dictatorship hasn't been too long ago, and even if we weren't, even if the country would not return to dictatorship, that we could see the erosion of democratic institutions. So I think that, you know, the memory of the dictatorship was, of course, really important for both sides. But I think that there's another memory that was important, and this is, of course, a much more recent memory, and that is the memory of the impeachment process. And why do I say that? I say that because I think that it goes back to this idea that dictatorship has perhaps been too long ago, and now we live under different times. What we saw during the impeachment was people going to the streets and asking for Dilma to be removed. And in a way, I think that this created this idea that if we don't like a president, we can remove them. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the comments that we would see during the elections would be on the lines of, we need to try something new. And if it doesn't work, we'll remove him like we removed her. And so I think that this particular memory of the impeachment that in a sense made people feel empowered in the political process was really important in shaping their attitudes towards Bolsonaro and also justifying this idea that, you know, he does say some things that might come across as outrageous, We don't think he's going to act on them. But even if he does, we can remove him from office.
That's really interesting, because that's almost, that implies that the public isn't being drawn to the idea of a return to the dictatorship, but actually has so much faith in their democratic process and civil society.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is this sense among a sector of the population that the dictatorship wasn't that bad. But at the same time, there is this idea that we do live under democracy and we do have a say in politics. And so it is this weird mix that does seem to have led to conflicting memories, but that in a way reinforce one another in justifying support for Bolsonaro.
So we've talked a lot about now of sort of the way that Bolsonaro, I guess you could say, weaponizes a certain form of nostalgia, and the way that the particular context of Brazilian politics has made people feel like they can go for a bolder anti-establishment choice. But so could you maybe tell us a little bit more about who exactly are Bolsonaro's supporters? Because, of course, in every situation where we talk about nostalgia, nostalgia is for a particular sort of person, right? Like, if you know, the obvious comparison recently with Bolsonaro has been Donald Trump. And in that situation as well, you know, it's not nostalgia for 100% of the population. It's a specific kind of person who ends up buying into that vision, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hesitant to just give a very generalized answer about who is the Bolsonaro supporter, right?
Yeah, especially because there's no single person.
Exactly. And the principal types of Bolsonaro supporters, right? But let me say this. Since the beginning of the election, what we have been seeing is that men were much more likely and much more ready to support Bolsonaro than women. Men did vote at much greater rates for Bolsonaro than women. And what we saw was that more educated and wealthier people were also more likely to vote for Bolsonaro. This was particularly true in the South and Southeast. And so if we don't think about individuals, right, but we think about perhaps municipalities or states, what we do see is that the municipalities and states that were the wealthier ones were the ones that ended up being the most supportive of Bolsonaro, and the less economically developed municipalities and states were the ones that supported the PT candidate, Fernando Haddad.
Right. So, and even though women were less supportive, does that class divide kind of apply in the gendered context as well? So do you think, or do we know, were wealthier women more likely to support Bolsonaro?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we did see this polarization among women themselves as well, right? So in the latest polls before the election, what we saw was that the women vote was basically divided between Bolsonaro and Haddad. And it was, on average, wealthier women, especially from the South and Southeast, more educated, who were more likely to vote for Bolsonaro. And so we did see this polarization extending to women themselves as well.
So your research talks about gender and political participation more broadly, right? So could you give us maybe a little more background on your existing research and how the Bolsonaro victory figures into that and the implications for it?
Yeah, of course. So as you mentioned, my research is on women's political representation in Latin America, but especially Brazil. And I look at how formal and informal institutions affect the prospects of candidate nominations and elections of women. And in the context of the elections, we can think about a number of ways in which this research actually plays a role. And so let me actually start by talking about the legislative elections, because what we did see was that this anti-establishment feeling didn't only impact the presidential elections, right? It also extended to the legislative elections. As I hinted to before, you know, the legislature saw very drastic changes in composition. The traditional parties lost a lot of space, and we did see high rates of turnover. And what we did see in these elections, in this context, is that the rejection of traditional elites So we still saw a cap of 30% of women running for office in terms of candidacies. And this pertains to the quota that parties have to respect. But we did see an increase in the proportion of elected women to the Chamber of Deputies. So we saw an increase in 5 percentage points. We saw more Black women running for office this year than ever before. And we saw some very important figures of the feminist movement in Brazil winning office. And so we have people like Aurea Carolina, people like Talíria Petroni, people like Samia Bonfim, who are now young feminists, two of them who are Black feminists, taking office in the Chamber of Deputies. So we didn't see an increase in women's representation in the Senate, but we did see an increase in women's representation in state legislatures. And one of the things that is important to think about here, again, referring back to my research, is that the thresholds for these women to get elected are much higher, right? Because oftentimes these women are running with a much tighter budget, without the support of the party machinery. And so their candidacies and the fact that they won office is very, very important.
Why don't they get the support of the party machinery? Simply because they're women?
Not necessarily because they're women, but because they are outsiders. And so traditionally what we've seen in Brazil is that parties tend to benefit those who are already in office and the traditional party leaders. And so, and that goes for how funding is distributed, how time on TV is distributed. So in Brazil, we have reserved time slots in TV and radio for campaigns, and the ways in which these times are distributed are not equal at all. And they tend to benefit these traditional party figures. And so, you know, we outsiders and newcomers often do not have the same level of resources that people who have been in these parties before do. An innovation or a difference in these elections was that due to decisions from the electoral court, 30% of the funding for campaigns had to be distributed to women's campaigns. Now, what we did see was a lot of creativity being used to employ these resources. And so even though the decision was to, in a way, match the quota and actually make the candidacies of the women nominated for legislative elections to be real candidacies and not phantom candidacies, which were what we had before. So women would be registered, but not in effect be running. That's not necessarily the way in which the money was distributed, right? So we had the money being used for, say, governor races or races for the Senate. So majoritarian races rather than the proportional races that are the ones in which women ended up receiving the least support. So that's one thing that is important to consider in regards to these elections, is that even though the institutions were there to promote women's candidacies, perhaps more than ever, we still saw the same patterns of resistance from these traditional elites to try to keep these women from power. But at the same time, voter dissatisfaction with the traditional elites did push for a renewal in Congress. And this did lead to a higher representation of women as well.
So those are women who are trying to break into the existing institutions. And there's a set of challenges that come with that. But then also, a lot of resistance to Bolsonaro came from women organizing on the streets. And I know you're doing some really interesting research on that as well, which you spoke about at Cambridge last week. Could you tell us a bit about that as well?
Yeah. So one of the biggest things in this election was the women's vote. And the women's vote became very important because, as I was saying before, men very early on displayed high levels of support for Bolsonaro. But there was another thing that was important. Voting in Brazil is mandatory, and you can vote for a candidate, but you can also vote blank. And there were higher rates of undecided voters among women since the beginning, and this gap was quite significant. What we saw was that candidates realized that women's votes were going to be very important, not only because they seemed to reject Bolsonaro at higher rates and therefore were perhaps more open to voting for someone else, but also because they were undecided at higher rates and therefore everyone was sort of trying to fight for their votes. What we saw was that presidential candidates responded in two ways. One, by nominating female VPs. So of the five main tickets this year, we saw that four of them were gender balanced. And of course, one of them was led by Marina Silva, but three of the other ones had VPs that were women. And then the other thing that was important was that candidates started to focus on women as voters in their spots on TV. And so they would talk to women directly. They would raise awareness about women-related public policy. And so they would talk about things like violence against women or respect for women in the labor force and equal pay. And so those were some of the things that became very important throughout the race. Now, what we saw was then the women's movement becoming more and more vocal against Bolsonaro. And this movement started online. So we saw the women's movement increasingly expressing very clearly a position against Bolsonaro. So Bolsonaro, in his time in office, had made, and again, that spans like three decades, right? Had made multiple comments that were sexist and misogynistic, and women were then taking a very clear stance against his candidacy based on his positions towards women, but also LGBTQ groups and also because of his racist comments, etc. So the women's movement didn't only focus on Bolsonaro's misogynistic and sexist comments, and I think that this is something important. But anyways, the main thing was that women started leading this opposition movement. And it started online in two ways. One was a Facebook group that was created that was called Mulheres Unidas Contra Bolsonaro, United Women Against Bolsonaro. The group was created and very quickly it became huge. Right now it has 3.7 million women, but that, you know, the group reached that number within weeks.
Sorry, I'm not sure if I missed this or if you said already. What's the platform? Is this a Facebook group?
Yeah, it's a Facebook group.
With 3.7 million members.
With 3.7 million
That's
members.
That's incredible. Okay.
All of which are women. And anyway, so it's a secret group. And in the beginning, people would have to be invited to it and then you could find it. Anyways, but it reached an incredible number of women. And this group started organizing both online campaigns as well as street protests. The Ele Não hashtag, the Not Him hashtag, became one of the most important hashtags of the anti-Bolsonaro campaign. And that was also something that was launched by women. And then women took it to the streets in protests that were present in all of Brazil's 26 states and the federal district, and also abroad in many countries. Of course, in these protests, it wasn't only women participating, but what was very unique about these protests was that they were all led by women and overwhelmingly composed by women. What we see after that is that women who were undecided then start to declare their votes in public opinion polls. And women started declaring their votes. And what this did was that it diminished the gap of voter support among women, of course, between Bolsonaro and Haddad. Some people started to talk about the women's movement and especially the street protests as leading women to support Bolsonaro. And I think that that's the wrong interpretation, because what we do see is that one of the most important determinants of vote was education and socioeconomic background. And so I think that what we saw after the street protests were actually women who hadn't previously, you know, declared their votes, but who were already more likely to vote for Bolsonaro anyways, and who wanted to differentiate themselves from the women who were on the streets.
So why would women want to differentiate themselves from the women on the streets?
One of the things that I think is really important to understand and emphasize is that women, as men, are a heterogeneous group. And so we have progressive feminist women as well as conservative women, right? And as I mentioned before, the interests of a very significant sector of women was more aligned with Bolsonaro than with Adaji. And so we did see, as I mentioned before, this very similar pattern. The women's vote didn't differentiate itself as much to the male vote, even though we did see, of course, much higher support for Bolsonaro among men than among women. But this split in the women's vote did follow this pattern of more educated, wealthier women from the Southeast supporting Bolsonaro. You know, we can't ignore that women are heterogeneous and have different interests and aren't all progressive.
Right. So what are some of the gendered interests that would draw women to Bolsonaro? So I guess one of them that has been talked about a lot is the notion of public security and order. So violence against women has high rates in Brazil. And so having a figure who promises security and order would be appealing. Are there other ones, or is that one true?
Yeah, so Bolsonaro himself talked about this, right? So what I mentioned, that candidates started campaigning and talking about women-related issues, Bolsonaro also did that. And some of the issues that he would talk about were precisely the ones that you mentioned. So he would speak about femicide or sexual violence against women as issues that he could handle much more firmly than other candidates. And of course, his view for it would be, and he talked about this openly multiple times, that women would be more empowered or less likely to be subjects of violence if they had guns, right? If they could protect themselves with guns, as this was one of the campaign promises of Bolsonaro. The other thing that was really important during this election was, you know, one of the things that I haven't mentioned before, but that I'm sure many people have heard, was that these elections were shaped by fake news. And one of the most important, most salient fake news was the fake news related to the gay kit. And so there was basically the gay kit was this idea that Adaji, again, the PT candidate, had, when he was education minister, proposed that kids learn about, or like were given this gay kit at school, and kids as young as 6 years old would learn about sexuality. But the main thing about the gay kit was that it would turn kids gay. And part of this was this baby bottle that was shaped with, you know, with a penis on top. And so, like, there would be all of these graphic images of a baby bottle with a penis on top circulating online and saying, look, this is part of the gay kit. And this is one of the things that the PT wants to do to turn children gay.
And sorry, aside from that being ridiculous, these are entirely fabricated, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So these are entirely fabricated. It's crazy that I have to say that. But there were no baby bottles, being distributed in Brazil. But the other thing that was going around and that is still very prominent after Bolsonaro's election is this idea that besides, you know, the gay kit, there is this idea that is not a new idea in Brazilian politics, that we need to make schools neutral. We need to make schools nonpartisan. So actually, there has been a bill called Escola Sem Partidos, so a school without partisanship, that has been going on in Congress for for some time now, but that gained more salience again with the candidacy of Bolsonaro and actually since his election, that proposes that schools or that teachers shouldn't be able to talk about anything that could be construed as ideological in the classroom. And this stems to a lot of things, right? From gender in and of itself to comments against Bolsonaro. And so actually the day after Bolsonaro got elected, one of the deputies, state deputies that was elected from his party, launched a WhatsApp channel where students were supposed to send recordings and reports of their teachers or professors who said anything anti-Bolsonaro or anything that could be construed as ideological in the classroom. And since Bolsonaro's election, what we've seen is that things like fake news mentioned in the classroom have been understood as ideological, and there have been students filming their professors talking about fake news, or of course, gender. This has led, reasonably so, professors and teachers in Brazil to be really concerned about the future of education in the country and about their own safety in the new administration.
So going back to what you were talking about with social media, because I think that's social media is a broader issue in a lot of these elections and in the elections of anti-establishment candidates. Do you think that this has been overall, maybe this is too broad of a question, there are all of these different sort of like cleavages between people in Brazil, between different kinds of groups and also within groups, like you're saying about different kinds of women who support different kinds of candidates and remember things in different ways. Well, so how is social media aggravating all of these different groups, do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, and going back to this idea also of what's the side that social media is on, I think that, so in thinking about the elections itself, what we saw was that social media was very important for Bolsonaro's campaign. So because Bolsonaro came from a very small party, he was not given a lot of time on TV or radio, and he was also not given a lot of money for his campaign. So social media was actually a very big part of where his campaign took place. And you can see that his name was by far the most mentioned on social media. And here I'm talking about Facebook and Twitter, right? And in Twitter, there are multiple studies and research that's starting to be published that actually shows that a lot of the discussions that brought up Bolsonaro's name during the elections were actually coming from bots. So there's research being done at the FGV in Rio that shows this. But there was another element about social media that was important for Bolsonaro, which was, of course, WhatsApp. And so one of the things that came to light just before the second round of the elections was that there had been packages of WhatsApp messages that were bought precisely to support Bolsonaro's campaign. And the purpose of these WhatsApp packages was to share fake news on WhatsApp. And so WhatsApp was a very important way of campaigning, not only because of the time that you spend on it, but also because of the engagement, the type of engagement that you do, which is much more active, as well as because the people who are sending you the messages are people that you normally know and trust. And so I'm sure that if you talk to Brazilians, regardless of who they voted for, one of the things that they probably agree on after these elections is that family groups were a nightmare on WhatsApp. Everyone hated them. We would get, I don't know, 300 messages a day. They were all memes. But anyways, and there was a lot of fake news being disseminated on WhatsApp.
So the context here is, of course, that in Brazil, famously, basically everyone uses WhatsApp, whereas in other countries, of course, other kinds of social media are preferred. So what you're saying, I guess, is then the specific sort of like character of WhatsApp as a platform affected the kinds of fake news that disseminated and who they disseminated through.
And also how much people trust them, right, if they're coming from your family.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But what I was going to say as well is that even though in terms of volume, social media might have benefited Bolsonaro and shaped his candidacy quite significantly, what we've also seen is that social media has been a tool for resistance and for opposition to Bolsonaro, right? And so, as I mentioned, the Facebook group managed to gather millions of women in just days and organize both online and street resistance towards Bolsonaro. We also see the voices who perhaps we wouldn't hear otherwise becoming more prominent in social media. And the other thing that we're seeing is organizing happening after Bolsonaro got elected. So one of the things that we're seeing with this women's group now is, where does it go after the elections? And what is being done is having this platform as a way to organize the movement and think about is its institutionalization in the future. So one of the things that is being discussed is perhaps turning the movement into a political party or an NGO. And this is all, again, being done online in a way that wouldn't have been possible otherwise, right? And so, again, this is a group with 3.7 million women, most of whom, of course, don't know each other, are spread across the country and also abroad. Many women who are part of the group are actually Brazilians living abroad. And so this has been a way for collaborating and organizing both domestically and abroad, and both for online strategies of resistance as well as street and institutionalized forms of resistance.
So a lot of the criticism about the Women's March in the States at the beginning, at least when it started, was in terms of inclusivity, and a lot of that was around trans rights and like how we conceptualize women. So in kind of figuring out an agenda for going forward and such within this group, do you see any particular problems that are coming up that women are grappling with? And is inclusivity relevant here? Is that also something that's come up in this context?
Yeah, when the group was formed, straight from the beginning, actually, it did say very explicitly that it was open to trans women. Now, I've started doing some research, some survey research with members of this group. And what I did find, and here, you know, what I have to say, the disclaimer is that respondents are not representative, right? So it was a convenient sample of people who saw the post and responded. As you can imagine, a group with 3.7 million women, not all of them are active. And there are a lot of posts going on. So what you see and what you don't see, in a way, determines your interaction with it. So anyway, so far I have collected around 800 responses. And what I do find is that overwhelmingly, the women on the group are white women, also more educated women, and women who identify themselves as feminists. As I mentioned, the group since the beginning was open to trans women. One of the creators of the group is a Black woman from Salvador called Ludmila Teixeira. She has been very important, not only in creating the group itself, but also in determining, leading the conversation about where to take the group next. And so there are important voices from Black women shaping the group's directions, but we don't see that being reflected in the group's composition, at least from the data that I have collected, right?
Mm. So I guess drawing then again on diversity and intersectionality. So the big question for a lot of people internationally following Bolsonaro's win is, what does this mean for human rights in Brazil? And what does this mean for things like public safety and his responses to things like criminal violence and whatnot? And in particular, I wanted to ask you about what you think the implications of this are going to be for marginalized groups like LGBTQ people, indigenous people, and non-white Brazilians.
Yeah, we're already seeing that things aren't going to be good for marginalized communities, right? We didn't even have to wait for Bolsonaro to take office to realize that. As I said before, you know, in the beginning of our conversation, one of the things that we talked about was that perhaps this memory of the dictatorship as something distant led people to think that or to take our democratic institutions for granted. And while I do not think that we would have, you know, a return to dictatorship, what we are already beginning to see is an erosion of democratic institutions. And this doesn't even have to be, a coordinated effort, right? And so even if Bolsonaro himself doesn't say we won't protect LGBTQ rights anymore, what we are seeing is that institutions at subnational levels are responding in a way that goes according to, you know, people's own understandings of what this government is and what it will represent for them and others. And so this puts marginalized communities at a particular vulnerable position. Because, of course, there is a real fear about what the federal government and Bolsonaro's government is going to represent for marginalized groups. One of the things that I heard a lot during these elections was that, well, but these elections aren't about, you know, LGBTQ rights. They aren't about equal pay. We need to take care of more pressing issues like public safety or like the economy, without realizing that all of these issues actually impact different people differently, right? And so they have heterogeneous effects that are based on race, that are based on gender, that are based on sexuality. And so one of the things that we're already seeing in terms of LGBTQ is that there has been an increase in marriages. So people trying to get married while same-sex marriage is still legal. So the fear is that with Bolsonaro taking office and together with a very conservative Congress, because even though there was a lot of turnover this year, we still elected a very, very conservative Congress, the most conservative Congress since the military dictatorship. And so that the combination of Bolsonaro in the presidency with a very conservative Congress would lead to the criminalization of same-sex marriage. And so there's a lot of people trying to get married now. Of course, his policies or his promises about public safety would impact in particular Black communities and especially Black men. We already know that young Black men are the ones that die the most in Brazil from homicides, right, in Brazil. And so we know that this is going to impact this group in particular in a disproportionate way. What we also see is that even though femicide rates have decreased among white women, they have increased among Black women. And so, you know, this, and we also know from research that having a gun in the household tends to increase rates of femicide. And so that is also something that could impact particularly Black women. As I mentioned, there's also this perhaps not coordinated impacts of other state level or municipal level institutions. And I think that what I was mentioning before about the initiative of this one elected deputy in creating this channel to report professors and teachers is an example of that, right? So we'll have these different initiatives that, again, are not coordinated, right? But that will nonetheless have an effect in people's lives and rights very directly.
I think those are some really good things for us and our listeners also. I think you did
Thanks so much for joining us.
Sorry, I will end with one wrap-up. Is there one takeaway thing or something you want to leave the listeners with?
You know, I think that Bolsonaro's election came from a very complex context. And of course, as a political scientist, but also as a Brazilian, I've been trying to understand what happened, but also where we're going forward. And not only me, right? Many other political scientists and Brazilians themselves. But I've been trying to, in a way, think about what are some of the positive things that we can think about all of this. And I think that one of them is that we can be sure that the women's movement is not something that only took place during the elections. I think that the women's movement is going to continue as playing an important role in opposing, resisting, and monitoring the Bolsonaro government. We will see marginalized groups leading this resistance and this opposition and keeping Bolsonaro in check. And so I think that this is something that is important, because it's all through these movements that we may see the emergence of new political leadership in the country. You know, if anything, I think that we should keep an eye out for this ongoing resistance movement. And of course, especially being abroad, the other thing that I think we should do is, of course, make sure that we are using the spaces that we have to give voice and to expand the opportunities for this resistance movement to actually reach more people and to reach out internationally as well. I think that that's going to be very crucial in terms of our role as academics outside of Brazil.
That's a great takeaway. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever been part of a Facebook group with 3.7 million followers, so that seems pretty hopeful, I think.
Yeah, kind of crazy. But to be honest, you know, it's not as hectic as my family group.
Thank you so much, Valerie. That was, that was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Declarations. Please subscribe on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at DeclarationsPod. Like us on Facebook, and of course, tune in next time for more Declarations.
I try to suppress these thoughts, but they leak out in second level through the head wound of my third death. I was imperfectly repaired.
Vote, please.
Yes, a bit frightening, isn't it?
Final votes. 4-9. Against, 586. Sentence, George Seddon will be aged 5 years.
I have seen the future, and it does not work.
Zardoz!
They make you old, but they don't let you die.
So what's to stop you killing yourself?
I do now and again, but the Eternal Tabernacle simply rebuilds me.
Into a world of eternal life, Zardoz brought the gift of death.
Fight back. Fight from death.
20th Century Fox presents a John Borman film.
Zardoz.
It took careful breeding to produce a slave who would free his masters.
Welcome to paradise.
Zardoz. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without parent.
Caution. You are approaching the periphery.
Roseanne Cash for the American Association of Diabetes Educators.
Johnny Cash was my dad. For years he had diabetes but ignored it, even as his vision and health slipped away. Diabetes is serious. It can steal your sight, your limbs, even take you away from the people who love you. But it doesn't have to be this way. If you have diabetes, test and control your blood sugar regularly. You'll be healthier and you'll feel better too. To learn more, visit healthywithdiabetes.org.
दोपहर को कहाँ गई थी?
दोपहर को बाजार गई थी।
पता क्यों नहीं जा सकती थी?
अरे अभी इसकी क्या बताना?
पड़ोसियों से पता चलता है मुझे।
पता चले तो क्या हुआ?
चुप। ये घर मैं चलाता हूँ। मुझसे पूछे बगैर कोई काम नहीं होगा इस घर में। चल चला समझ।
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ।
घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/HideInCopfire.
How I've been affected by gun violence over the years is through deaths of friends and family members and associates.
When I was 5 years old, I was held at gunpoint in a home invasion.
I've gone to the juvenile detention centers and I've met dozens of young kids, babies really, who have been affected by gun violence.
Directly, I've lost a few friends, but I think why this touches my heart is having children of my own.
You know, I've been at parties where, you know, I had just left the party and, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes later, you know, I heard that, you know, somebody got shot and didn't make it.
There are a lot of people benefiting off of our pain, and it's time we do something.
I'm here to unload my investment because I think that it's important that we start kind of seeing where our money is going.
It's time to go to your financial advisor and demand that there are no gun investments in your 401k.
Even if you don't have investments, you can still help spread the word.
This is something everyone can do.
So if you push your people to have 401ks, it might be your grandma, it might be your cousin, this effort can make a big impact.
I'm unloading for my loved ones that I lost.
I'm unloading for my 18-year-old self.
I'm unloading my 401k for the future of my children.
I'm unloading.
I'm unloading
for my family and their future.
I'm unloading so that my daughter can grow up in a safe, loving world.
Unload and join the movement.
Use hashtag I'm unloading to pledge your support for gun-free investing.
In Parkland, Florida, the sun rises with 17 fewer children and adults. 17 fewer children and adults violently taken away from parents and families on Wednesday. The following are the names of Republicans and their career totals paid by the National Rifle Association to ensure gun laws never change and more innocent children and adults are murdered. 1. Senator John McCain, Arizona, $7,740,000. 2. Senator Richard Burr, North Carolina, $6,986,000. Number 3, Senator Roy Blunt, Missouri, $4,551,000. Number 4, Senator Tom Tillis, North Carolina, $4,418,000. 5, Senator Cory Gardner, Colorado, $3,879,000. Number 6, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, $3,303,000. 7, Senator Joni Ernst, Iowa, $3,124,000. 8, Senator Rob Portman, Ohio, $3,061,000. 9, Senator Todd Young, Indiana, $2,896,000. 10, Senator Bill Cassidy, Louisiana, $2,861,000. 11, Senator Tom Cotton, Arkansas, $1,968,000. 12, Senator David Perdue, Georgia, $1,825,000. 13, Senator Pat Roberts, Kansas, $1,584,000. 14, Senator Pat Toomey, Pennsylvania, $1,467,000. 15, Senator Ron Johnson, $1,269,000. 16. Senator Mitch McConnell, $1,261,000. And 17th, Representative French Hill, Arkansas, $1,089,000. These are the names of 17 Republicans paid by the National Rifle Association to make sure gun manufacturers keep their power and money no matter the cost in blood. A historic footnote. Since 26 people were killed in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012, more than 430 people have been shot in 273 school shootings. We do not have to tolerate thoughts and prayers. Quite a few of these Republicans are running for re-election. Register. Vote them out. In the meantime, join the movement. Go to everytown.org. I'm Tom from the CoffeeCast podcast, heard on demand on the Progressive Voices app or Progressive Voices on TuneIn, Stitcher, and iTunes.
Now that America has a black president, is this proof that racism is a thing of the past?
Well, I think white men were 100% of the people that wrote the Constitution, 100% of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, 100% of the people who died at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, probably close to 100% of the people who died at Normandy. This has been a country built basically by white folks in this country who were 90% of the entire nation. I think they ought to do. They ought to defend the legitimate rights of white working class folks who are the victims of discrimination.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal media. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
It's our news act.
Evening. It is now 7:01 here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and always online at kpfa.org. Please stay tuned for Bay Native Circle.
No, Kimawish, Kumawish.
You know, it's been over 200 years since the gold was discovered here.
It was against the law at that time to be Indian.
Liable to destroy our own rivers and meadows. The same man that put us on reserves and ghettos. The same man that's on those dirty dollar bills that you praise. The same white collar ballers that be treating you like slaves.
Oh, great spirit, grandfather, grandmother, thank you for this beautiful red day you've given us, and thank you for our lives.
Good evening, relatives, and welcome to Bay Native Circle here.